forever.
We here at Household Faces are going to take a little hiatus for a while. It is a lot of work to do the show the way I want to do it, and it is summer. But we are going to do a couple of special one-off episodes, and the archives are still there for your perusal. Tell a friend, get in there, listen to the Marilyn Ricegub episode, listen to the Kevin Pollak episode, Gordon Clapp, Jim Beaver, Bruce Greenwood, Beth Grant, Parvesh Chhina, Adrian Scarborough, Kurt Fuller, Paul Dooley. There are so many good episodes, 45 plus episodes in the archives there for your listening pleasure. Tell a friend, give us a review, and thank you for being part of our family.
I remember doing a scene somewhere in season two where at the end of the scene, I mean, I saw it on the screen because I didn't, that I was literally bouncing, doing this thing with that I didn't do. My body did this because that was the character. I wasn't consciously thinking of moving and grooving and doing what it, so if you're in character, your body will do what it's supposed to do.
That's great.
It was, and I went, oh, that's cool.
Hello and welcome to Household Faces, the podcast where a character actor interviews other character actors. I'm your host, John Ross Bowie. You might know me from The Big Bang Theory or Speechless or a couple episodes of the NBC show About a Boy, where I played Fiona's boss, Fiona at the time being played by Minnie Driver. And that's how we met. And that probably gave me an edge when it came time to audition for Speechless. So yeah, it all connects, man. Our guest is Stephen Root. I mean, where do you start with Stephen Root? Well, we start with Barry. We do Office Space. We cover a little West Wing. We cover news radio. Yes, we cover George Romero's Monkey Shines. We talk about the transition from Shakespeare to sitcoms. It is a really tight, fun conversation with a guy who I actually met a few years ago on a show that we both happened to be guest starring on, and we'll touch on that as well. Please welcome Stephen Root. You strike me, we were just talking about the nightmare feeling of waking up too late for your call time.
Oh, my God.
Especially when you're on location.
Especially when you're, yeah, like you're in Toronto or you're Vancouver or whatever.
Guest, let's just say Canada.
Yeah.
And you're sort of a guest in somebody's house, somebody's
right.
country.
Right.
And then you're like, and I feel like you're the sort of actor who really prides himself on his punctuality.
Being on time.
Yeah.
Big thing for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big thing for me and big thing for... it's hard because if your spouse is the kind that likes to get to the airport right to walk onto the plane,
no,
and
you
want to be the guy that's there,
no, thank
in plenty
you.
Of time.
Why would you leave any room for error at the airport, particularly
uh-huh.
now?
Yeah, that's a conversation I've had 150 times.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm team you on that. I don't want to get involved in your marriage.
Not
your
at
marriage
all.
Is your business.
And she knows. It's okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's all good.
Okay. I was reading... I just actually started this book, big onerous book on The Method by Isaac Butler.
Okay.
It just came out, and it starts with the origin story and, you know, a letter that Nemirovich sent to Stanislavski. But the five tenets they started for the Moscow Art Theater, the fifth one was be on time.
Be on time.
Just be on time, man.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
be on time, be prepared.
Content.
And you may be able to stay in the business.
Yeah.
But both of those things have to happen.
Well, I think you can be... We're going off on a tangent that I didn't expect to start this early, but I think what I have found, and tell me if you think this is right, you can be late and a pain in the ass as long as you are making other people a ton of money.
That's correct.
But the second that stops,
mm-hmm.
then you're
then
just
you
a pain
stop.
In the ass. Yeah,
then you
stop.
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah,
then you're not worth the hassle.
Exactly.
And people need to... it's we cannot be reminded enough that it is called show business. It is not called show friends.
And it's, you can have a career or you can have been in show business for 5 minutes and be in a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the, a very common thread among our guests is that they have careers and they have been at this for a while and they get there by being consistently easy to work with, even if they're not, you know, the person who's going to get their film greenlit, you know?
Sure.
But let's start with, we'll sort of bounce around chronologically. I'm not caught up on Barry, but I love it so much.
I think you'll really, it's deep this season. I think you'll love it.
Yeah, I've heard. It gets deeper. It actually reminds me of Breaking Bad in the way it gets a little darker and a little scarier with each passing season.
Kind of has to with the lead as PTSD.
Right. You know, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And you find out more about how he got there.
Right.
And what's interesting about it is that it could so easily be a perfectly solid hour and 45 minute feature comedy. Mm-hmm. But what keeps it from doing the hitman wants to be an actor is dimensionalizing all the characters around him.
Correct.
And I want to talk about Fuchs for a moment because he's such an interesting guy. His loyalties shift constantly, so our loyalties shift constantly. Mm-hmm. There are times when we're rooting for him and he's you know, we pity him, and there's times where he's a fucking snake.
Right.
How do you... I'm going to ask a real acting 101 thing here. How do you motivate that? What is the motivation for playing Fuchs?
Good writing starts with it.
Sure. Okay.
You know, and it always does. And then if that continues, you're able to find the different colors in the characters if the writing is good. And on this show, you were able to have input in that with Bill and Alec.
Okay.
And we also learned that lesson very early when we did the pilot. And I wasn't playing this guy in the pilot. I was playing a screaming asshole only. And that was fun.
Sure.
But HBO and Bill and Alec went, well, if he's at 11, where are we going to go?
From there, right?
So they retooled it into Bad Uncle. So you could start with, buddy, I need you to do this for me. And that gives me to go finally to 11, which I get to several times.
Yeah, no, and there's a couple moments in season two when you're, spoiler alert incoming, when you're encouraging to off that kid.
Correct.
You know, where if you can't come out of the gate like that.
Which becomes a linchpin of the whole series.
Yeah,
yeah.
It would have to. So that's amazing. So did they reshoot your scenes in the pilot?
They did.
Wow.
They did.
You recognize how lucky you were to just not get recast.
Completely.
Okay. I had a feeling you might.
That.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they're like, we want to keep this guy. We want a different version of this guy.
We don't want this version of this guy. But I think we had enough fun with the other version of the guy that they said, well, he can do this. He's been in a couple other things. So so I was feel very blessed that they didn't say, hit the road, Jack.
Because he's on time.
I was on time.
Punctual, and that makes...
And I would do some of my stunts.
Really?
Yeah.
You're also sitting here with a pillow in your lower back.
Okay.
We'll get to how that happened as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the tone on set then. Hader and Berg obviously have a pretty clear-cut vision for this show.
Supremely.
But you also say it's very collaborative.
Yeah, it is. They want you to be able to be free within the confines of what they're thinking of. You know, because Bill will come in one day and say for a scene that you're completely prepared for, and he'll go, I don't like any of this. What would you say here? So you're put in the position to be a collaborator immediately.
Right.
And if you don't have an improv background, that's harder to do. For me, I came from Shakespeare and straight plays and theater in New York. But it was a great tool to be able to learn even at this advanced age to, you know, just let it go. You know Fuchs at this point. Just go, what would you say? What would you do? And we did that several times, have done it. When we see a script, we're able to give input and say, I don't know if he would, which is amazing. You know, you don't get to do that on 90% of the shows you do.
Yeah, I'd say about 90.
Right.
There's moments where I'm watching Fuchs and he's almost like, he's a scavenger rat almost. And
he is.
Because you're talking so much about your theater background, and I know you have a BFA.
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
You have an honorary BFA.
I was in the BFA program. I only got an AA because I left to go do National Shakespeare Company in New York City.
Okay. Correct. Interesting. In that time, getting your AA, did you find yourself doing animal exercises or anything like that?
We did all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, in college that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but it's funny because that's the thing that, like, that non-actors make fun of actors for all the time.
I don't blame them.
Yeah, I don't blame them at all. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the hope is that you never, ever see the means. You just see the end. Because God forbid they see us crawling around on the floor. But there is a quality of the desperate animal to Fuchs sometimes. And I'm wondering if it's so in your bones right now that you don't even realize you're doing it.
Yeah, and I've talked to some other people about this. I remember doing a scene somewhere in season two where at the end of the scene, I mean, I saw it on the screen because I didn't, I was literally bouncing, doing this thing with that I didn't do. My body did this because that was the character. Yeah. I wasn't consciously thinking of moving and grooving and doing what. So if you're in character, your body will do what it's supposed to do.
That's great.
It was, and I went, oh, that's cool. You know,
do you find it? Can you are you one of those actors who can watch themselves
once?
Oh, okay.
Once.
Interesting. Okay. Once.
I because as most actors will tell you, all I see is why didn't they use that take or I did this better. Sometimes on this show, I've watched it more than once because I'm proud of the work on this show. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the very few that I would watch again, I think.
That's neat to hear. I'm not surprised. Yeah, it's a very nuanced, I mean, you're all so good. There are no small parts on that show.
I try desperately not to read scripts very carefully so I could just watch them as a fan because I'm a fanboy of the show.
Yeah. And no, it there's an enthusiasm running through it, and just every single student in Gene's class has a moment that is so pure and true. Mm-hmm. Satirical, yes, but anchored in so much LA truth.
Such good actors they got for the show and continue to get.
Yeah. Let's talk about Florida. You went to high school in Florida? You bounced around a lot.
Yeah. My dad was, I was a construction brat instead of a military brat.
Okay.
Did steam power plants, took a year and a half, boop, go to another, boop, do another. So I was basically a military brat.
All over the Southeast?
All over. Well, mostly ended up in the Midwest. I was very... Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, Wyoming.
Okay.
And then this last job, which took me out of my senior year of high school, ripped me out of that and put me in Florida. I wasn't happy with that. And it cost nothing to go to University of Florida in 1970.
Wow.
Didn't cost a lot of money. So it was a state school. So that's where I ended up.
Did you go in with an eye on theater?
Not a bit. Never. No.
No.
Okay. I was the school photographer. I thought maybe in that journalism. So I signed up for journalism major. But like a lot of people just took an elective and went, the student directors would go, will you come in and do this? Okay. And then you get bit.
Right. You get up there and you get a laugh or you get a gasp.
You go, I think I could do this.
Yeah, and what's a little more instant gratification than photography, which is a lovely art.
Very much so.
We have a lot of people who come into the show who are big into the visual arts.
Sure.
Yul Vasquez, Xander Berkeley have come in to do the show. Yeah. Xander's a terrific painter.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot that they get from that. What did you get from photography that you find yourself bringing to theater, to acting?
To appreciate the eye of the cinematographer. You know, I love to that's the first person I want to see, and he shows you, well, it's going to be this.
Yeah.
You're going to come in here and this and the picture, and it's like from doing photography I get that and can appreciate it.
Having done, and I'm on camera here so I can having done theater, multicam, and drama, do you find yourself adjusting your performance with frame size?
That's a great question, yes. I mean, because I came from straight theater, which was, back to the wall.
Right.
Especially doing really, really big barns, like in Boston and, really big houses.
You have a couple of Broadway credits, right? A
couple of Broadway credits, and I did the national tour of Daisy, Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, okay.
With Julie Harris and Brock Peters. I mean, two of the greatest stage actors ever.
Yeah, yeah.
And we played all over for 2 years. But that was a great training. But that was pretty much the end of my theater career, because at the end of that, I moved to L.A.
I see.
In 90. And that experience of then being guest star boy in sitcoms, you know, doing Roseanne and, mm-hmm. and Night Court,
yeah.
and those kind of things are a smaller version of a theater audience. It's 200 people. Mm-hmm. So you've got to adjust your performance to that, and then the close-ups that the camera is going to give you as well. So that was 3 years of learning how to do that.
Just bouncing around doing guest work on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's we talk about the delicate alchemy of sitcom,
yeah.
multicam acting on the yeah. show a lot. You know, which I guess is going to...
Which you've done a lot of.
I've done a ton, yeah. And I always call it theater with a safety net.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Because you do...
Get to do it again.
Yeah.
You do get to do it again.
You do get to, and on the worst case scenario, you screw up, the audience saw a blooper. That's fun yeah. for them. You know, don't make a habit of it, but, you know, now and again.
They're fine.
They get pizza. they do around what would be the second commercial
But they
break.
Have to endure the warm-up comic for an awfully long time.
They do. Yes. You know, that's okay. So there's a warm-up comic that keeps an audience excited and jazzed in a multicam audience. And there was the same guy named Mark Sweet on Big Bang Theory,
sure.
which is where Steve and I initially met. And Mark's probably the best to do it.
Yeah,
He's a magician. He's a hypnotist. He does a but he gets song contests going.
It's incredibly,
you don't realize
job.
How hard that job is though yeah. until you see it done poorly.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Someone who's just like, round of applause, guys. You're like, oh, that's awful.
You know, that's the seventh time you're seeing the scene, but let's give it everything like, you got!
On. What if these jokes were new? So you get the bug, but when do you realize that this is something you can do for a living, or does that even enter your mind? Is it just like, fuck it, I'm going to do this whether I can make a living or not?
Yeah, I got it a bit bad enough that I did, you know, several big productions in college, and I one of the first one was Shrew, which was great fun.
What did you
and
do
one
in Shrew?
Was
Grumio.
Grumio.
Yeah.
Grumio and Shrew. And nicely, thank you, in Guys and Dolls.
Oh, my God.
And just... You know, so yeah, I was already all in by the end of my time at
those
college.
Are two huge scene-stealing comic roles.
Wonderful things. Yeah, and I think probably the only thing I did in town that wasn't there was at the Hippodrome Theater, which is a big theater. It's now the State Theater of Florida, but I got to do Charlie Brown for them. I got to do Midsummer for them.
Who'd you play in Charlie Brown? Who'd you play in Midsummer?
Charlie Brown.
Nice, good.
And
tell me you're
one
of
the Mechanicals.
Okay,
yeah,
good. I just I don't want to
had to be.
Yeah, I don't want to waste you as Lysander. So if you go to college in 70 and you don't finish, that puts you in New York like 73?
No.
No,
because I those first 2 years were journalism, so
oh, really?
I had,
okay.
still had to go do the 3-4 years of that, but I didn't make it through. So 75.
Still, 75 to move to New York.
Yeah.
It was all I ever knew, so I kind of just took that level of grit for granted.
I was in Florida, you know, and then I was in
and
New
not
York.
Even in, like, Miami. You were in Sarasota, right?
I was in Gainesville.
Gainesville, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I was born in Sarasota, but literally 3 weeks.
Okay.
That was all okay. I was there.
Okay.
But, yeah,
Massive culture shock. Okay.
I mean, I was the guy that got into the bus station, you know, on 42nd.
Oh, my God.
And Ratso RZA would came up and go, hey, buddy, how you doing? It's really good. I want to tell you something. Really happened.
Raised in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Matriculated in Florida, you just look like less hip John Voight at that point.
Goodness, I was so green. But fortunately, Philip Meister and the National Shakespeare Company got me situated in New York. And I did that for 3 years around the country, but it was always situated in New York.
But they do an interesting thing. They would do real spare bus and truck productions.
12 people on the trailways with the set being literally 4 hydraulic genies curtains a stairway that goes up and down the end.
Yeah.
Go.
A friend of mine, do you know Rob Corddry?
I don't know Rob, but I think he's amazing.
Rob cut his teeth in the 90s doing National Shakespeare Company, touring the country doing...
I've got to talk to him.
I'm seeing him for lunch later. This is crazy. Yeah.
Philip was probably dead by then, but okay, go ahead.
Andrew Aguecheek in Twelfth Night, and I think he did Horatio in the Hamlet they were doing. And they would play open air, like amphitheaters, school gyms.
A little room in a junior college, that was the best training you could possibly get.
It would have to be, right?
It would just... Because you were doing a different show every night, even though it was the same show.
Well, I mean, if you do a run of anything in the same theater, every audience is different. But if you're moving across the country, across different venues, I can't think of anything that would build more at a... See, you say you don't have an improv background.
Well, I kind of do. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. We had to improv exits and entrances and volume control and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just you had like the sort of safe cushion of Shakespeare's text to
lean
back
on.
You up. Yeah.
Not that we didn't do modern versions of some shows.
Sure, sure. Yeah. What shows did you do?
First year, we did a wonderful 20s adaptation of Comedy of Errors.
Great.
Played one of the Dromios.
Oh, great.
And the most beautiful show that is never done, Winter's Tale.
Wow. Well, Winter's Tale's tough, man.
Winter's Tale's tough, but it's the most fun to do.
Why do you say that?
It's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
It's a fairy tale with a jealous king, but it's, I don't know. I found it the most fun to do of all the dramas, and it is a drama. We did, so those two and Twelfth Night, maybe? Yeah, the first year, and the next year we did Othello and Midsummer. Oh, God, it's hard to remember now.
That's
but,
so
yeah,
fun, though.
All
that
stuff.
Been such an incredible, just an incredible training ground.
Oh, the best.
But you end up in L.A., and did you find yourself almost instantly working in multicam?
I had to.
Well, it's not.
Because we had just had a baby in 89.
Right.
On the road.
Oh, wow.
The road. So I had to hit the ground and book.
Right. But specifically, you found yourself doing sitcom work more than hour-long drama and
stuff. I did, but we had sat in LA for 6 weeks doing the show. So every casting director in town had seen the work. And that's when I said, I've got to move right now.
Right.
I've got to go right now and not just a body coming in from New York.
Right.
They've actually seen the work.
The iron is hot. I must strike.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I've done a lot of comedies in theater. So that was the natural way to go first.
Well, that is my question. I had an acting teacher one time tell all of us that so much of the American sitcom as we understand it has its roots and its character archetypes in the Commedia dell'arte.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that a lot on news radio in particular.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of, and I think I've got my archetype right, sort of Il Dottore, kind of
the
buffoonish authority figure here,
yep.
Right?
Very much so.
Was that conscious? Were you, I mean, because there's something Shakespearean. It really is. I loved that show.
Of the two that I talk about that I'm proudest most is those two, Barry and News
Really?
Radio. Yeah. Yeah.
Then everything else is going to be downhill after this. I'm sorry. But,
no, that's okay. No, it wasn't downhill, but those were special.
No, they really
were special. I mean, they were, and it was an ensemble. They're both ensemble pieces.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. And the other thing that, you know, News Radio being a traditional workplace comedy is an ensemble where you're all up in each other's grill constantly, a genuine ensemble where the ensemble has to work together right.
And everybody has to be funny with everybody else, which doesn't happen all the time.
No, that's specific.
I could be funny with Andy. I could be funny with anybody. Andy could be funny with anybody.
Yeah.
Phil could be funny with anybody.
Yeah, and what was Phil like?
A sweetheart. Mm-hmm. A meticulous, you know, you wouldn't think, coming from Saturday Night Live, which was a dog-eat-dog atmosphere, we had to beat him down a couple of times and say, no, we're going for the gold for everybody here, Phil. We don't want to upstage you. And it took him a year to go, oh, okay.
Oh, to trust the rest of you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but he did. But he was a guy that would have his, you know, whatever the first script was, in the folder, in different tabs colored tabs for each scene. He was very, very meticulous and a great artist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Artist. He did the Poco cover.
A graphic artist before he was a comedian. He was fabulous. One of the things I found so inspiring about him was that I was starting improv at 27 when he died, but mm-hmm. I was just like about to get headshots at 27, which is a relatively late start for some people. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have already decided that this is what they're going to do. And when he died, I was crushed and I started reading so much. I didn't realize he'd gotten such a relatively, he was in his mid 30s before he started to take Groundlings classes.
I didn't appear on camera till I was 34.
No, that's fantastic.
It was all theater before that.
That is great. There's something about Hartman that I was going to say that I noticed. I saw an interview with him one time where he was talking about how he came to Clinton, and he obviously has a great ear and everything, but his Clinton was an equation. It was Elvis and Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
And you listen to his Clinton, like, oh, that's exactly right. And it's Bill Clinton. You did it. You actually figured out the math. So I'm mm-hmm. not surprised to find that there was a
very meticulous side of him. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. What were...
And then there was Dave Foley, who could look at a script and go, okay, good, got it.
Oh, really?
It's like, I want to punch him in the face every day.
But it was so interesting, though, because, you know, he had to be... It's such a crazy workplace. He's got to be the voice of reason. He's got to ground it.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of us didn't realize he could necessarily do that coming from Kids in the Hall. From Kids,
yeah. No, Dave had the hardest job on the show, which was... neophyte to used up piece of tissue by the end of the show.
No, yeah, he gave it a very long, painful arc.
He
but
did, it was brilliant. I give him all the props in the world. He was a tremendous actor on that show.
But there was something very when you started doing sitcom. Did you immediately realize, like, oh, this is, I actually have done something like this before. This is within my wheelhouse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had somebody tell me that you auditioned for a sitcom by figuring out the filling in the following blank. This character is the most blank person in the world.
Mm.
And that can take you to a very, very big place. But if you ground it somewhat, it's a nice mm-hmm. place to start.
Yeah.
And again, this is just like multicam sitcom. Again, we're talking about like the old school, sure. almost farcical thing.
But what they're going to probably hire you for is your strength. What your strength is.
Okay, what's yours?
Mine was, hopefully is sometimes, timing.
Yeah.
And, you know, not being afraid to make a complete fool of yourself, which you have to be good. You have to just look like a freaking idiot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there's no other way around it, really. No vanity.
You just have to. There's no vanity. No vanity. And I'm more than willing to do that because I'd played Grumio and all these other clowns.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, bang! Yeah. That's fine with me. And so you massage that into whatever you want to do on a sitcom.
Speaking of wonderfully unvain roles, I got to talk about Milton because everyone wants me to ask about Milton. When I was talking to you, and you know, we had Dietrich on just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I love
so you
Dietrich.
Are you are at least our second Office Space alum. But there's, and you'd worked with Mike Judge before.
We were doing King of the Hill.
Right, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. But you hadn't done anything on camera with him. Did he make you?
No.
But you'd done some shorts as that character.
No.
No, I'm wrong. Okay.
No, you're wrong. He did the voice himself for the short.
Oh,
he did interesting. The voice himself. Yeah. And in fact, when we did the read for the network, he was going to read it. And he said, nah, I don't want to read it. You read it. Thanks for the prep. He showed me the pencil sketch.
Okay.
That he did. He said, do something in this realm.
And he showed you a drawing.
He showed me a 2-minute pencil sketch.
Oh, I see.
Movement.
Animatic.
Know, animatic, black and white.
Okay.
And I said, okay, I get the idea of the guy. And I gave him on the spot a little lisp and a couple other things, and it went down that road.
What was it about the drawing that you brought a voice to? What was it?
It wasn't the drawing. It was the script. The script, okay. I completely got the script.
Okay.
And we had been working together on King of the Hill doing multitudinous characters each episode.
Right.
So it was easy to slip into whatever he felt like, whatever he wanted to do that day. And that day it was Milton. And it just happened to be, it turned out to be a cult thing. So
I've asked this question of other people before. Were you surprised at that film's second life?
We all were. We figured we were doing a B comedy for a lot of fun with a lot of people that were on King of the Hill.
Right.
So the reason it became, I think, what it did was it was literally at the dawn of the blockbuster generation. It was.
Oh, yeah.
It's right when Blockbuster came out. So you could see something over and over and over and over again.
There was a massive, huge chain video store in your town.
Right.
Yeah.
And you could rent this movie 500 times. People did. Yeah. And it became a word of mouth movie.
Yeah.
So that's where its life came from. And then every 10 years, different generations discover it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to matter that the computers, you know, huge motherfuckers.
It's funny. Yeah. The argument in my house is my wife wants to show it to the kids, and I'm like, I mean, I love that movie because I worked in a bunch of offices in my 20s.
Exactly.
And just that moment, I fell in love with the moment where he just gets shocked on the doorknob. Like that moment, right, and it's maybe the first 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah,
that moment was like, oh, this is the genius, this is a masterpiece, this is Citizen Kane, where has this been all my life? But I worry that my kids haven't earned this movie yet. That's what I'm thinking.
I hear you.
You know?
I hear you. They just haven't had enough life experience for it yet.
I need them to have a couple shitty temp jobs, and then we'll...
I'm sure they've been in a car that changes lanes, and you don't go anywhere. But that may be the extent of their experience.
I mean, I think it might work because you're all so good and so endearing and... do people do you get approached about that movie?
Only that movie.
Really?
Literally. It may be a dodgeball every once in a while.
You're virtually unrecognizable in that film, though.
Doesn't matter.
That's incredible.
It's really weird. Airports. It's all Office Space.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you appear on camera for the first time when you're 34.
Mm-hmm.
Is that on film or on TV?
No, New York, soap.
A soap. Okay, soap. You did a soap. All right. Uh-huh. And I went back and I watched a little bit of Monkey Shines.
First movie.
That was your first movie. Okay, first movie. George Romero's Monkey Shines, mm-hmm. Which I saw when it came out, but had forgotten you were in it. Forgot Stanley Tucci's in it. Pankow's in it.
Great actors.
It's a great cast.
Yeah.
It's one of the best. You know, Romero usually used sort of amateur actors, whoever was hanging around Pittsburgh at any given time. But he brings in some serious pros for this thing.
Yeah. New York pros. Yeah. Not necessarily me, but those guys. Pankow and.
You play the boss who
is
badgering the scientist to start showing some results. So he pushes science places where it shouldn't go.
Right.
And so it's a little bit of a horror cliche character, but you bring so much to it. What I was struck by was all of my early TV and film roles, I'm the lowest status guy. So I take whatever nervousness I bring to the set and I just bring it to the character. It's the easiest thing in the world.
Yep.
But you are so high status in that scene. You don't stand up. You're just sitting there being imperious, dressing down Pankow. Was that a challenge or were you just able to hurl yourself into
it? I think I was. I wasn't afraid of the experience because I felt like I knew what I was doing in theater. This can't be that hard.
That's fantastic.
You know, I think I was overconfident and I was glad that I was, because I learned right after that that film is a lot harder than you think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a...
But for that role and for that time, it was like, okay, let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, it speaks to the incredible importance of being on time and being prepared.
Prepared. Yeah. And I'm always super prepared for stuff and for auditions especially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The when we met, it was about 5 or 6 years ago on Big Bang Theory.
Got to be longer than that now.
Yeah, I guess so. I could look it up, but I remember where I was emotionally. We didn't have any scenes together, but on a multicam sitcom, you end up hanging out with everybody who's on set. So I met Steven, and I met LeVar Burton and Mark Hamill, and you know, it was a fun set for that regard.
Absolutely.
You would meet some pretty crazy people. Newhart.
Yeah. Amazing.
We had a ton of downtime. We both had about 2 scenes each in this particular mm-hmm. episode, and we were hanging out by Craft Services. And I was a few years into my 40s at that point and was noticing something that was happening to my field in my 40s. Do you remember talking to me about this? Because it was an interesting, like, the herd had thinned.
I was just going to say, it's like this. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, there's only people drop out of your strata and you go, where'd they go?
That's exactly what you said. That's exactly what you said whenever that was.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. It was yeah. You're like, where did everybody go? Yeah. And there was a striking thing around 40, which is absolutely when my career picked up a little bit.
Because mm-hmm.
I was also like such a baby-faced 30-year-old, and everyone was like, I don't know what to do with you. You're not a student, but you're not
right.
a dad. Fuck off.
Yeah.
So there was a kind of a weird, like, you know, yeah. I played a really old grad student on Big Bang. That was like my hook for a while there, you know.
Uh-huh.
But you I don't think you realized what a pep talk that was and how much I needed that little boost at that time.
No, but that was real life. I mean, I'd seen it 10 or 4 more years than you. As you go on in the business, the people drop out because of family stuff, because of financial things. They drop out. And so the watchword for having a career is just staying in it. You know, endurance is more than half of it.
Yeah.
To be able to stay in it. And I remember that very much. Yeah.
It was right around 40 and my work absolutely picked up. It was the damnedest thing because there were just fewer. There were people who were like, you know what, fuck this. I can use my charm and make money in real estate.
I think the thing that kept me going was also an Ed Asner story who would just got Mary Tyler Moore as he was about to go. He was 40, whatever.
Right.
And it's like, it ain't happening.
Really?
But he stuck it and he got that and that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sidney Greentreat mm-hmm. from Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, yeah.
That's his
one
first
of my
film
favorites.
Role.
Yeah.
That's his first film role. Yeah,
exactly.
He's 64 years old in the Maltese Falcon. That mm-hmm. is his first time on film.
Yep.
We've segued gracefully to the question I ask everybody. Who were some of your favorite character actors growing up? I feel like you've got a stack.
There probably is a stack. And if I wasn't 70, I could remember all their names.
Oh, I bet you're going to come up with a couple of them.
But I loved all those guys in the 40s and 50s, you know.
Elisha Cook Jr.
Sure. And for the life of me, I can't come up with a name right now. But I wanted to be Frank Morgan. You know,
oh yeah, sure.
I wanted to be Frank
the
Morgan,
actual wizard, and
right.
all the other roles in that movie.
That's what I mean. That's what I wanted to be able to do. I didn't know that was like very unusual that he got to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In that movie, but
well, how old were you when you realized it was all the same guy?
Probably in my teens.
Yeah,
yeah.
A little older than I care to admit, but I,
right.
But
right.
I remember at one point just the doorman when he turns out to be the doorman. I was like, holy fuck, this guy's in. He's like 1/3 of this movie is this guy.
Well, the guys that I love were Strother Martin. I wanted to be Strother Martin.
Okay,
I did want to be Ed Asner, which I got to be on News Radio, kind of.
Yeah, you had a slightly more benevolent dictatorship to your quality because you
yeah,
kind of, because
absolutely.
Jimmy didn't give a shit as much as Lou did.
Yeah, but I mean, I wanted to be in the milieu of different, completely different stuff.
Right.
And I got to do that, which was, I'm proud of myself for not staying with sitcoms more than 10 years and desperately trying, not desperately, just not taking them for a while to
yeah.
get other... You know, the CSIs and the West Wings and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they don't see you. The casting directors will not see you until you really show them that you can do that. And then they forget again.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, he only does drama. No, if you'll remember. So, yeah.
So did you actually talk to your agent and in like the late 90s and say, you know what, we're going to kibosh the sitcoms for a little while?
And well, I made that decision and said, this is what I would like to do. It was the only reason I was lucky enough to be able to do it was I was still doing King of the Hill. So I had a job.
Oh, okay.
I had a job and I could stop doing that other job for a while. And so I did. I went for a while till I got a couple of hour dramas.
Yeah.
And that was very fulfilling, especially to West Wing and that stuff. And that led to, you know, the HBO stuff, Boardwalk, and other things like that.
Well, yeah, and the movie where you play Richard Clark. There's a bunch of
right.
There's a bunch of in the early aughts. There's this gear shift where you become the guy behind the guy.
Right.
In some, I'm speaking in very broad terms, but in a lot of these political dramas.
Sure.
Let's talk about West Wing, because you're on West Wing post Sorkin.
Correct.
You're in like the John Wells years of the show, where it's a slightly different
vibe. Yeah,
it's
absolutely
a different vibe. It's even shot differently. It doesn't have that like Gordon Willis glow over all the characters it does, you know?
Yeah.
But
it doesn't
still
have the perfectionist thing that he had.
I still think it's a really good show.
I do too.
I think it's a really entertaining and interesting political drama that is maybe, frankly, a little less idealized than the first 4 years.
I agree.
What was your time like on that, getting on to this show that has won a slew of Emmys and is, you know, has launched people?
Again, I feel like I was prepared going in.
Okay.
You know, it was the same thing, audition that you have through your life. You see seven different guys that you've auditioned with, through time.
Yeah.
And you managed to pull out the job. But I felt like I was ready for that when it came along. And it was interesting to play the conservative. I mean, I was on the conservative side.
You've played a few.
Yeah,
over
well,
the
I played
years.
Hoover with in LBJ, the
That's
HBO
right, you
movie.
Did. That's right.
Which was very satisfying to get to do that stuff.
What is it about? I think I know the answer to this. What is it about Stephen Root that they cast you as conservative so often?
I don't know. I think it's my face. I don't know. Because it's so polar opposite of, you know, the broad comedies that I do, like the big I think they like that as much as I can, if they can get away with it with the casting director.
Oh, just like it'd be so interesting
to have him as another thing. Yeah,
to see Milton be a guy who's espousing the capital gains tax.
Exactly.
And, who's going against the, who wants limited government and all. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was jazzed when you showed up on West Wing. It's such an interesting, what I love about that era is that Alda is a not particularly religious California Republican.
Uh-huh.
He's not like,
they
don't turn him into a one-note, like, fire and brimstone
absolutely
guy. He's a, he's a very complicated kind of Republican who, unless I'm terribly mistaken, ends up working in some facet in the administration. And then I was a big West Wing fan. It shows. But
I got to work with Ron Silver and all these
that's
other
right, Ron
great.
Silver. Yeah, that's right. Stock question that I ask everybody. Was there a role that got away?
Oh. I don't know if it's the role.
No, sure. But it's always interesting to like imagine.
Do you remember the sitcom Grounded for Life?
Donal Logue.
Donal Logue.
Yeah.
Who I find to be one of the best
He's fantastic.
Character actors in the world. And that was his show. It was a sitcom, but I thought it was better than most.
No, it was very interesting, and it was sort of a weird.
It was weird,
multicam, single cam hybrid,
completely in my milieu.
Yeah.
To play his dad.
Oh.
And wait for it.
Okay.
I do the pilot.
Oh, really?
Do the pilot. I had just done another pilot before that, and it got picked up, and I couldn't do Grounded for Life as Donal Logue's dad. And guess who got the role instead of me?
I actually know, but I'd love for you to say it.
Richard Reilly.
Who is, of course the Jumped Conclusions guy from Office Space.
And Richard and I, you know, went up for everything
you
together.
You guys must see each other constantly.
We worked together in Black Rain
That
long ago.
Oh my God.
And then saw each other every year since at every audition.
You know what he's great in? He's great in the last Harold and Kumar film. He plays Santa Claus.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
You know what, it's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a holiday staple in my fucked up household, and I recommend it highly. That's it. You see, it's funny. I applaud you because usually the job that gets away is someone auditioned for something and didn't get it, but you did a pilot and had to go away.
What was the
series that went?
It's called Ladies Man.
Wait, hang on. Ladies Man. Wait, Alfred Molina?
Alfred Molina, and who is
friend of the pod,
who is
been on the show,
and a friend for life.
Okay,
because he's the nicest man in
the
world.
He's the nicest guy in the world.
And this show, unfortunately, didn't work. And did you know who was on that show?
I remember Sharon Lawrence.
Sharon Lawrence, Alfred Molina, Kaylee Cuoco at 16.
Oh, really?
Betty White.
Jesus Christ.
Exactly. What was wrong? Scripts, writer.
Oh man,
mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Still though, you could do far worse than spending time with those actors.
It was a joy to walk into that room with all those actors, and Betty White would walk in invariably, you know, after everybody, and walk by the room and go, "Hey, boys."
Phenomenal.
And would flash him. And she was the best.
She really was. You know, everyone's like, no one gets a pass just because they die anymore.
No.
You know, like, and if something nasty was going to come out about her, we'd have heard it by now.
No.
But there's nothing nasty. She was a delight. She was a genuine national treasure who should be on stamps.
Exactly. She and Julie Harris to me.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a great story. Cool. There has been, before Barry, there was a run of really interesting sort of indie films that you did and larger indie films that you
really enjoyed those, yeah.
You've worked with the Coen brothers a bunch. You know, let's talk about that. You worked with the Coen brothers, and then most recently you worked with just one Coen brother.
Yeah, it was interesting.
And in your triumphant return to Shakespeare... I loved Tragedy of Macbeth. I thought it was so well done.
I mean, just
part of me that was like, do we need another version of the story? I have to admit, I saw it coming out. It's like, I mean, I want to see Denzel do this as much as the next guy, but there was just one 6 years ago with Fassbender.
Yeah.
It's always on TV, and then it was fucking great.
Yeah.
But
this was a 40s noir movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
it was so interesting to shoot at Paramount, all built. Not one outside shot.
No, I noticed that.
And that was a pleasure to be able to work back in the time where I loved all those character actors from the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, well,
so
sure.
That's what it felt like. And these sets were enormous.
They looked huge.
They were enormous.
And stark, like high contrast black and white lighting.
Yeah.
And they don't have Venetian blinds, so they do it with columns.
Yeah.
So they get that same sort of like, you know, effect of people's duality and everything.
Yeah. I think Joel did an amazing job. And the cinematographer as well.
The
amazing
adaptation, when it was done, I was like, what did they, it's an hour 45, what did they cut? And I thought about the stuff they cut, and I was like, I didn't miss it. You're fine. Yeah.
Pretty much not.
It clips along perfectly. The porter is the lone laugh chunk. There's a little moments of dry wit here and there.
You have to have the 15th century dick jokes.
Yeah.
In order for Macbeth to wipe off all the blood.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, there's got to be that scene where...
You literally need the
time. Yeah, you need the time.
Yeah, it's almost like what they used to call an apron number, I think, in old theater. Is there a certain extra responsibility when you're like, well, this is it. I'm the comic relief in the Tragedy of Macbeth.
But I've been in that position in other stuff.
Right.
So I'm very happy to fulfill that role. And it was a nice thing for me started my career in a kind of as, you know, late in my career now. But to get to do it on film was great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. To have that immortalized on something that was a hit, too, that went really well and people saw.
Great, great cast. And a colorblind cast, which was really interesting and wonderful, I thought.
Yeah. No, it worked fine, though.
Worked, oh, I did. I thought so, too.
It worked great. And it was just a really smart way to take it out of, you know, medieval Scotland and make it a little more eclectic.
Right.
What's the secret to playing drunk? it's a pitfall for a lot of actors.
It is.
A lot of really good actors fall short. And I was, and you know, the porter is in a long line of shit-faced Shakespearean characters.
I think the real answer is that you have to have been really drunk a few times to be able to call on it and go.
So it's a method approach.
I remember. Yeah, a little methody for that. Because I think if you hadn't been, it'd be difficult to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to bounce around for a little bit here. You mentioned that you might have dinged your back a little bit doing dodgeball.
Yeah, a little bit. There was a stunt, and I'm not blaming dodgeball. It didn't really appear till way after dodgeball, but I think that was the genesis of it. I did a stunt on the car where the car hits Gordon.
Oh, right.
Excuse me. And to do the stunt, I was sitting on the car. The car starts up fast, and you go boom. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the start of my back problems.
Oh, no.
But it's okay, because I'm really conscientious about if I feel anything, I go into my rehab mode, you know, which is fine.
Oh, you're sort of...
Oh, yeah. My heat, my exercises, I don't not do them now anyway because... it just feels better to do them anyway. But
I just got into my 50s and I was trying to explain to a younger friend of mine, the advantage is you know immediately when something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately. And by this point, you have learned a couple tricks.
Yeah. And you know how not to exacerbate it.
Yeah, precisely. You know when to not be a hero. You know when to be like, hi, that guy who has my haircut, mm-hmm. we need him now.
Yep.
We would like the guy who wears this wig. We'd like him to show up.
Honey, where's the heating pad?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And I need to lie on the back with my feet up the side of the
right.
wall.
Yeah. And you have to do these little exercises to move you around a little. So that's just age, but that's okay.
What comes across in Dodgeball, which it's funny because the movie's like 15 years old at this point, but at its time, it was kind of a throwback to the group underdog comedies of the 80s to a
very much
extent,
so,
you know?
And but raunchier.
Oh, obviously
raunchier. With language.
Obviously
yeah.
raunchier, language, yeah. But I mean, it's Vince Vaughn doing the Bill Murray role from the early 80s of like
right.
the dry, smart-ass underdog.
Oh, I said, I'll do this role if you let me do Rick Moranis, which is what
fantastic.
I did.
Fantastic. That was
which is what I did, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
yeah.
But you don't, because you're such not a Rick Moranis type that you don't see the
but that's my homage to him. I mean, people say, you just stole that from Rick Moranis. I said, no. I actually, it's my homage to him because I think he was unbelievable.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
He is Rick Moranis is a real, real hero of mine. Actually, yeah. I'll overshare for a brief moment. My wife, before she was my wife, when she was just a friend of mine at the Improv Theater where we were coming up in New York, she disclosed one time, like, oh my God, I had the biggest crush on Rick Moranis. And that was the first moment in my head where I thought, I have a shot here.
Yeah,
oh, this might actually pan out.
Yeah,
she's you know, yeah, because it's not John Stamos, it's Rick Moranis. I could swing for the fences and pull this off here. Yeah,
Rick Moranis, if he did anything, if he this line will, you know, he could do nothing else and it would be fine. Like, we'd like a piece of your brain. Okay.
Yeah. Oh my God.
You know,
oh
it's like,
God.
Oh, there's nothing more brilliant than
the
that.
Sheer willingness.
Okay.
He's just absolute. I mean, that's yes and in a nutshell, right? Like, oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's in character,
yeah.
And it's fantastic. And we've just seen him play a demon beast for like a half an hour of that movie, and now he's back down to Lewis the Accountant. And then right around the same time, he's the sleazy agent in Streets of Fire.
Right.
The versatility is there. There's all the Second City stuff. There's an incredible Woody Allen he used to do. He's just, he is a wonderful guy. I don't notice the, it's funny, I now that you mention it, it's all I can think of, but I didn't notice the Rick Moranis homage, which is a lesson. Like, if you're going to steal from somebody who isn't
from the best. Yeah, no, you steal from the best.
Also.
And I've stole from many, you know, not overtly, but as sure. There would be something like this that one of my fairy character actors would do.
You're not going to throw that out into the void. But like who? Like who? No. from who else have you stolen?
Oh God, I don't know. I know intrinsically that I've stolen from Frank Morgan, say.
Okay.
Or such like.
Yeah.
So I don't stealing from the best is okay as long as you pull it off.
As long as you pull it off, and again, always defend it as an homage.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I want to talk about Get Out, which is one of those movies that improves with every viewing.
Mm.
It
There's a lot of tiny, tiny things in it.
Did you notice those tiny, tiny things when you first read it?
Yes.
You did. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. You're a careful script reader, aren't you?
I am. And that was one of those things, you know, you want to do not good, but great scripts.
Right. Yeah.
And so that was one. And the fact that he was able to get so small in that minutia, and he did in the second one as well.
Yeah.
But yeah. Get Out was special.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many little. I mean, there's all sorts of really fun videos online that talking about the subtext and the Easter eggs peppered throughout. You know, he uses the cotton to clog his ears. You know, all that great stuff. But it all hangs together really well. Did he talk to you? He's such a movie buff, Jordan. I mean, all directors are, but he really seems
he
to
is.
Be.
He, like, Hader is
huge
cinephile.
I've seen Hader be interviewed on the Criterion Channel.
Oh,
he's a big nerd, and it's endearing. But Jordan Peele has this quality where he finds a subgenre, not a horror thing, but a horror subgenre, because I want to do that. And did he talk to you a little bit about what was influencing Get Out? Did he talk to you a little bit about... Because I always watch it and I see Rosemary's Baby. I see a ton
of
Rosemary's Baby.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we didn't talk about that specifically. But yeah, we talked about character a lot. and I didn't want to – I felt a little udgy about doing another blind guy, which I'd done in Oh Brother.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be anything like that.
Okay.
So we talked about not making it like that.
Yeah.
But just in general character stuff, he was very specific. Like Joel and Ethan are very specific. I mean, they storyboard every fucking movie to the nines, and then they get there on the day and they go, well, we might do this.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, we actually got sidetracked about the Coens for a moment. Let's go back to them for a sec. What is the difference between working with one and two, or is there one? Are they really just...
No, they're really... They're
two-headed beasts, right?
They're two-headed beasts, and Ethan could have, you know, been there in spirit and probably was.
Okay.
No, it was the same working with Joel as working with Joel and Ethan, because they both did both. You know, they both produced, they both direct, they both, they're one head.
Have you ever gotten a contradictory note from, in the four or five times you've worked with them? Have they ever contradicted
I don't think
each
so.
Other?
No, yeah, I don't think so.
That's what I'm hearing from people.
They're nice enough to let you do the free take.
Oh, really?
I'm not surprised to hear that. More than one.
Okay, all right, yeah. But they'll let you hear one, though. It's such a meticulous, it's not like Wes Anderson meticulous, but there is
it's
deliberate.
Very tightly scripted.
Yeah.
But sometimes some stuff gets used, so.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, yeah. And they're very, very collaborative within the scope of what they do.
Do you have a favorite of the stuff you've done with them?
Oh.
I mean, they're all so good. I mean,
well, the most fun was probably Oh Brother,
right?
Probably the most fun, but I really like
DJ.
But I really like doing what is it? Won the best picture?
No Country for Old
Men. No Country.
Yeah,
because that was a kind of a departure for me. I always play these kind of weird, strange guys, but this guy was really odd. And to get to work with Javier, who was frightened that his hair was too weird. And we had to tell him every day, no, the hair makes it, baby.
The hair makes it. Well, you also have to, like, you have to de-sexy Javier Bardem right out of the gate if he's going to play that character.
Yeah.
You got to unsex him here.
He was worried about it, but no, we assured him every day that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'm telling you. But yeah, I really
love
it. It's
like the glasses in Office Space, really. It's like, oh, I immediately know what I'm looking at right now, don't I?
Oh, yeah. That was hard because I had no depth perception.
See. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There's just no depth perception. I had to practice reaching for
the stapler.
Because I couldn't, It could be here or it could be way over there. I don't know.
Amazing.
I didn't know.
But yeah, so you were saying it was a departure. It was a different kind of weird for you.
Yeah, different kind of weird for me. And working with Woody was just so fun.
Yeah.
Because Woody really, on the free take, Woody went. It was so fun to watch him.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And they used some of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I got to watch that again.
Yeah.
I got to watch that again. It's a very upsetting piece of work, but it's so well done.
So good. And there's no music in this movie.
Yeah, I know. There's Which is hard for them because they love music and they use it so well.
I think the mariachi is on the bridge. That's the only music.
Okay.
But there's no background music in this movie.
It's almost like one of those really stark 70s movies.
Yes. Way, like Panic it's very Park 70s movie. Yeah.
You know, where there's a little music on a radio in the background, but that's it. Like, there's no scoring per se.
Right.
And it gives you this...
moving the bag and the thing is like...
That's the isolation in that movie. I think that's what upset me so much, but it's so good.
So good.
Are you between Barry seasons right now?
We are.
Nice.
We start in August for season 4.
Nice. And have you seen scripts yet? I'm obviously not going to ask you to do
I have seen a couple of scripts that... The day after they sent them, they said, never mind, we're going to change it all. So I don't know.
Well, that's exciting.
But that's normal for this. It's like they get a better idea and they go, oh, no, let's just write the edge. Because the best thing about the show is it's going, and then it goes left or right. You don't know where it's going to go.
I cite Breaking Bad because it's the last time a TV show made me gasp quite so often.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's this moment after moment of, and you know, you like to think you get to my age, you're kind of jaded, you've seen it all, but it's still so surprising, and the jokes work, and the tension works.
Works.
Yeah, it's a real gem. Best of luck with it.
Thank
you. Think you're going to come back to the stage?
I briefly went on in 16. I went, did a show at Playwrights.
That's right, yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah.
But it was really hard to block out that time.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Sure, sure.
It's a long time to block out.
It's a long process.
For $1.50.
It's a money suck. Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. But I wanted to do it for that play because it was a new play. And I got to work with Lois Smith. The end.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so.
No question.
And then I got to do a movie with her, Uncle Frank.
Oh, wow.
Which was fantastic.
I'll admit I've not seen it, but I've heard it's
great. I'd really like you to watch it.
Yeah.
It's one of the best indies that I've done.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. I think.
I remember seeing posters and being like, oh, that sounds really good. And then just, you know, things. And then I had a bunch of catching up to do to do this. And I had to rewatch a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's a good one.
And what's great about your career and the reason you're not recognized enough on the street is a tribute to your versatility, sir.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm always happy that I can be a little bit under the radar. You know, it's nice.
It's nice. Right?
Yeah. I feel very fortunate for that.
Stephen Root, thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that is an episode wrap on Stephen Root, who is not on social media, which is probably why he is so pleasant and friendly. He begins work on season 4 of Barry very soon. Forever Dog.
Household Faces is a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by John Ross Bowie, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Produced by Ben Blacker. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcast.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook. Until next time, when's lunch? I want to send a heartfelt thank you to Forever Dog, Ben Blacker, Jordan Katz, Anna Rubinova, and everybody who helped make this very personal project a reality. That is an episode wrap on me.